Forget werewolves, move over vampires and zombies? Oh, they are so last year. Robots are back in vogue for summer science fiction. This hour, the author of Robopocalypse joins us to talk about a robotic revolution. Plus, if those lazy, hazy days of summer find you slumbering in a hammock, you may be dozing off quicker than you think. A new study shows how that rocking motion may make you sleep more deeply. And finally, they paved paradise and put up a parking lot, but did they pave it with porous concrete? This hour, a look at green paving technologies, like concrete that lets rainwater sink right through. Our goal is to keep these podcasts free. Here's how you can help.
You can support the show by trying GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Use GoToMeeting to bring people together, colleagues and clients across the country or around the world, to collaborate in real time. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMeeting.com and use the promo code SCIENCE.
Thank you, Anna. And now, on to the show. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Are you one of those people who 5 minutes after you get into the back seat of your car, your mouth's wide open and you're snoring? We all know some kids, adults who drift off in a flash in moving vehicles. It's like a grown-up version of being cradled in your mother's arms, rocked back and forth, or perhaps falling asleep in a hammock. But why does that rocking motion speed up the onset of shut-eye? Well, some researchers decided to find out by rocking people to sleep in little laboratory beds, wiring up their heads, and measuring volunteers' brainwaves as they slept. And it turns out that that side-to-side motion actually seems to synchronize your brainwaves, findings published this week in the journal Current Biology. How is that rocking movement able to change your brainwaves? And instead of prescribing drugs, might doctors prescribe a rocking bed to people with insomnia? I can see the new rocking bed products coming out already. What do you think? Our number 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry at SCIFRI. Let me introduce my guest. Michelle Muhlenthaler is a professor of neuroscience in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Geneva in Switzerland, and he talks to us from there. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Muhlenthaler.
Hi.
Hi there. What made you decide to do this study?
Well, originally, years ago, I used to go to Paris very early in the morning, collaborating with people there. And it turns out that at 6 o'clock in the morning, taking the train, I found people at a time where you were not supposed to go to sleep, at 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock in the morning. And these people would sleep almost immediately in the few minutes after the train departed. And after that, my main research was completely out of this subject. But I had the opportunity recently to come back to that and ask the question why it works, how it works. Mm-hmm. Obviously, for all the people, it would be eventually evident that this should work, rocking babies and sleeping in a hammock. We wanted to look scientifically how it works.
And what did you discover after you had volunteers take a nap in a rocking or a still bed, and you compared their brain waves?
Exactly. So what was expected and what we wanted basically to quantify and give a real measurement of was that people go to sleep faster. That's more or less obvious. We have quantified that, and we're able to show it finally. But the absolute surprise for us is that during the period of the nap, all the time of the nap, the brainwaves actually, so beyond the fact that you went to sleep faster, the brainwaves during that period of rocking were changed in a matter that was consistent with the notion that the sleep is actually deeper. So the brain waves, the way they show you that it is deeper relates to particular waves that you can measure with EEG, electroencephalogram. And the result was consistent all throughout the period. So it's not just at the beginning of the rocking, it's all through the period of the nap.
Are you able to tell why the rocking creates these brainwaves?
These brainwaves that you find are actually the natural brainwaves that occur during that period of sleep, whether it is in a nap or at certain period during a night sleep. So it's not just that it brings new waves. It just fortifies brave's waves which are already there intrinsically naturally. It just makes them, to make it simple, it makes them stronger, which explains why the rocking works, because it makes you faster asleep, and then while you are rocked, actually the rocking maintains you in a deeper sleep. That was a surprise for us.
That maintains you in a deeper sleep.
In a deeper sleep. It's not just you go faster to sleep, but also while you sleep, your sleep is deeper. That was a total surprise for us. We did not expect that. There was nothing in the literature to tell us that this would be the case.
So that would imply it's a healthier sleep, a deeper sleep?
Not necessarily healthier, but deeper sleep usually means a better recovery, if you want. So it's just maybe that in a shorter period of time you might get more of restoring sleep, if you want. It's not better. It allows you to pack in a shorter period of time. The one thing which is sure is that the type of waves that you see, which are reinforced here, have also been associated with an increase in memory for recent events. So it's true that from that point of view, this type of ameliorated, you would say, sleep could be beneficial also for cognitive purposes.
So you remember more.
You remember more, yes, exactly. So we did not do that, but right. People have shown that while you are sleeping, the particular waves that we have seen are related to the quality of your memory recovery, if you want. And so it means that if you have more of these particular brain waves, you remember better. Mm-hmm. So what we do is that by the rocking, we might have something that give you a more profound sleep, and in addition, maybe some additional better results.
Now, you only rocked your test subjects for about an hour, right?
No, it's less than that.
Actually,
it's a duration of a nap. It's 45 minutes. And it is true that for the time being, we don't know what would be the result for an entire night. The only thing I can tell is that the very few experiments on entire night were done in the last few days. And those people that have been rocked in an entire night, at least qualitatively, say that it was very pleasant. So, and they slept well. But we don't have yet the EEG analysis and so on, and it would need a lot of people in order to be able to give real strong data.
So you need to collect more data on that full length.
Yeah, and more data and analyze the EEG for the whole night. For the nap, the data that we have are perfectly sufficient. We have very strong statistically very strong results.
Is the vibrations that you receive on a train equal to the kinds of vibrations you get in a rocking motion or a hammock? Is there something consistent about them?
You know, the type of rocking that we had was chosen empirically, in the sense that what we did is we tried some stronger vibration, and people didn't feel well with that. So I guess there must be some kind of similarity between them, but we didn't go and measure exactly what kind of frequency you have exactly in a train, because in a train you have several things. You have the movement, you have the noise, and things like that. But what's true that, for example, when you have people sleeping in the train, as soon as the train stops, people tend to wake up.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, they tend to stop at stations. Yeah. Actually, we didn't think of that. It's one of the interviewers in the last few days.
Someone who does a lot of sleeping on trains myself, I can attest
probably.
That's good that you wake up when you get to the stop, because I hate it when you go by that stop.
It's true, but when you sleep an entire night on a train and you are on a train with many stops, it's very annoying because basically at every stop. And after that person suggested that, I did remember trips that I myself had done, and that's correct. Every time the train stops, tend to wake up.
I can imagine that there must be bed manufacturers who are very interested in this study.
Yeah, four of them already called us. We have to deal with them to make sure we can get what we want and not they get what they want.
We've heard about Swedish mattresses. Now we'll hear about a Swiss mattress or a Swiss kind of bed.
We'll see.
Does it? Is the rocking motion? Does it matter? You know, some cradles they sort of rock like a hammock, but yours went just linearly back and forth, right?
Yeah, exactly. Actually, in many U.S. Media publication in the last few days, people wrote the thing, because this is journalistically nice, that it's a hammock, but it was not a hammock. The hammock was just in the first sentence in order to connect people with the story. But the device we used is just a bed. It's a regular bed with a small silent motor that was rocking it just from the side.
So rocking is really not what happened. It was a sort of sliding back and forth.
Yeah, it's not actually rocking. You are right. It's actually sliding. It's a little bit rocking, but it's like millimeters because it's suspended. So there will be some kind of... But basically, since the movement itself is a few centimeters on each side, you can basically see it just sliding, yes.
Oh, so it's just a few centimeters. It's not a foot or
a few
two.
A few centimeters, yes.
Yeah, so it is more like a train.
Movement.
Yeah, then it is more like a train movement than a hammock movement or anything like that. Wow.
I don't know.
Yeah, so you're going to lengthen your test out to a whole night, do you think?
Yes, because this is really the interesting stuff potentially in the future, because as you might know, sleep, as everybody knows, sleep is a major problem for many people, major problem with growing older. And basically the response to sleep problem is pharmacology, and pharmacology is good.
Yeah.
In the short term, pharmacology is not great on the long term. So it could be an alternative if it works on all nights, which we don't know for the time being. It could be an alternative to drugs in certain type of sleep problem.
Or maybe
we need first, before we try it on people who have problems, we need first controls an entire night, and this is exactly what we are doing now.
Well, Dr. Mulataler, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today. Good luck to you. And Michel Mulataler is a professor of neuroscience in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Geneva, talking to us from Switzerland. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back and talk about what happens when robots attack. You don't want to miss this one. Stay with us. We'll be right back. To help keep these podcasts free, we need your support. Here's Anna to tell you how.
Thanks, Ira. This episode of Science Friday is sponsored by GoToMeeting.com, the award-winning web conferencing application for Macs and PCs. One of the ways business gets done these days is by bringing people together, sharing ideas, and collaborating. And more, the people you want to work with are across town, or on the other side of the country, or even around the world. So how can you help them make the best possible contribution to your business or project? It's simple. GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting is the web conferencing tool which enables colleagues and clients from remote locations to see your computer desktop on their computer screen, which means you can collaborate from a distance, form closer relationships, and be more effective. Use GoToMeeting for virtual meetings, product demos and reviews, sales presentations, training sessions, and status updates, just about any type of meeting. You can schedule GoToMeetings in advance or hold them on the fly. Try GoToMeeting today and receive a free 30-day trial and help Science Friday, too. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click Try It Free, and enter the promo code SCIENCE. That's GoToMeeting.com, promo code SCIENCE. Make your next meeting a GoToMeeting instead. Back to you, Ira.
Thanks, everyone. Now, back to the show. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. President Obama launched today the National Robotics Initiative, aimed at spurring interest in next-generation robotics. Speaking at Carnegie Mellon University, he quipped,
"You might not know this, but one of my responsibilities as Commander-in-Chief is to keep an eye on robots. And I'm pleased to report that the robots you manufacture here seem peaceful, at least for now."
But what if they were not? See, just about everything around us is really a little robot. Tiny computer chip brains are embedded in all of our machines, from your cell phone to your coffee maker, your car to your cable. What would happen if all those computer-controlled devices decided not to be peaceful, but to rise up together and rebel? Well, a new science fiction book takes these fears to the extreme. Robopocalypse is set in the near future when robots get so intelligent that they have a mind of their own, they band together to destroy humankind. Sounds pretty scary. Well, I'm not going to give away the final conclusion of the book. That's for you. That's for you to find out, unless you feel complacent. My next guest says we'd better get used to thinking about futuristic technology. Someday you might have a robot do your chores, fight your wars. Wait, don't we have that already? Uh-oh. What would happen if they turned to attack us? Do you have fears of technology? Do you love it? Are you reading Robopocalypse? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry. Let me introduce my guest. Daniel H. Wilson is the author of the new book, Robopocalypse, and also the nonfiction book, How to Survive a Robot Uprising. And he's a contributing editor to Popular Mechanics. Also, he has a PhD in robotics. He joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Nice to have. This was a really fun book to read. And
really?
Yeah. It was a page turner for me, at least for me, because I like science fiction. And you have created the world where everything that has a computer chip, right, decides to attack humanity.
Well, yeah, it's set in the near future. So, you know, it is a robot uprising sort of book, but the robots don't come from outer space or
right.
the future or anything that. So like that. So it's definitely it's in the near future. So autonomous cars are here. All the information that we've shared, that we constantly share about our locations and our social networks, and yeah, all that information, all that intimate technology really gets turned against us in this book.
Mm-hmm. But one of the things that it struck me about that is that you remember Isaac Asimov had three rules of robotics, and they were that robots could never attack their creators. Create a whole paradigm shift in that.
Well, you know, I have to go on a little rant about the three laws then. a roboticist doesn't program a machine in English. You know, I mean, you can't just convey these three laws to a machine and have it obey the laws. And also, people seem to forget that Asimov crafted those three laws primarily so he could break them in really interesting ways to make all these sort of detective-like, stories. And so, you know, the three laws are great to think about and to conceptualize, but really difficult to actually employ in a machine.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I mentioned before, you are a trained scientist in in robotics, but you've now ended
Mellon.
Up. Yeah, but you
Which
ended.
Where,
go ahead.
It's where Obama spoke today. So
that's right. Yeah. What did you think of his statement? He said, "Yet, you know."
You know, he's mentioned something like that before earlier, and I've always thought that it's really funny that he has a sense of humor about it, you know. I mean, especially because he's passing or he's, you know, he's creating funding to really build infrastructure and manufacturing, and, you know, it's sort of like could very easily be boring, you know.
Yeah. Do you
but not whenever he adds.
Do you think we are headed in the direction of your book? I'm not talking about the revolution, the robots rising up, but that they'll be such a part of our lives in the future.
Absolutely. I mean, I love robots, and I love robotics, and I think that they're a great addition to they're something that people should absolutely be building. They solve a lot of problems. And I do think that, you know, we're a technological society, and we're getting more and more technology, and a lot of that is going to appear in the form of robotics, and not necessarily humanoid robots. You know, they don't have to look like people to be robots. So, you know, right now we're in a situation where robots have their fingerprints on a lot of things that we interact with daily. You know, they are building all of our gadgets, and there's artificial intelligence algorithms that are figuring out where stuff should go on shelves, you know, in supermarkets. They're figuring out whether we should get credit cards, and they're solving these intellectual problems that we can't deal with. But we don't actually interact with a whole lot of physical robots like we imagine in pop culture a robot looks like. You know, instead, we just live in the robot's world, and they're building it for us every day. I think in the future, we'll have a lot more interaction with real robots, though.
Do you ascribe to Ray Kurzweil's idea that technology is going to get infinitely more intelligent than we are?
Yeah, no, I really don't. I mean, I understand it intellectually, but if you're just in the lab and you're building a robot, okay, it is so hard to make it do anything right. I mean, it's such a huge challenge to iteratively improve on your research and to make your, to reach your goals. And so the idea that, you know, it's just going to suddenly exponentially, magically on its own take off and start to get really, really smart, to me, that sounds like someone telling me that, you know, elves are going to come into my shop and do all the work for me in the night, and I'm going to wake up and it's going to be done. I can't see it.
So your book then is not a warning about the future?
It's really not. It's framed as a robot uprising scenario so that basically you know what it's about, right? Robopocalypse. Right. By the time you get to the fourth or fifth syllable, you got the gist of the plot. But from there, I really try to get more complicated about what's going on. You know, it's an autonomous, artificial construct. This thing's alive. It's got thoughts of its own. And so, you know, the robots in this book are not necessarily 100% concerned with people. They're not out to destroy humankind. In fact, I mean, we're definitely at war with them in the book, but that's not their main goal. I mean, they got other things going on. So, that's a theme of the book.
I think it's cool that you had a book before it, How to Survive a Robot Uprising, Tips on Defending Yourself Against the Coming Rebellion, which is a tongue-in-cheek book of hints.
Important to note that's a humor that goes in the humor section. Well, you know, I wrote that while I was a grad student at Carnegie Mellon, and I was actually sort of annoyed that robots are always the bad guys on television and in movies, and I'm aware that I've kind of the irony of Robopocalypse. Mm-hmm. But I just went around and asked all the roboticists I knew what they would do, you know, if their robot attacked. Yeah. And usually they'd say that they would they'd go up one stair, you know, up one step or walk away slowly. But then I asked them to sort of take it a little further. And so How to Survive a Robot Uprising is really a primer about robotics. You know, it's got a lot of information about robotics, and it's actually is used in some introduction to robotics courses. Mm-hmm. And it does it in kind of a fun way because human beings are just really naturally fascinated by the things that we're afraid of, you know. And so whenever you frame things like that, it just becomes automatically more engaging somehow.
What made you decide to give up your career as a robot engineer and become a writer?
You know, I got into robotics because I love the robots in pop culture, you know, and I love how robots straddle this line. They started out as pop culture, you know, in the 50s and before then, and RUR, and then they kind of have become real. And so I took a similar journey. You know, when I was younger, I was really into robotics and science fiction. And then when that didn't take off, I decided to study robotics for real. And then I had the opportunity to write about them after that. And, you know, it felt natural. So,
yeah. So And they're making a film out of your book, correct?
Yeah, so DreamWorks optioned it, and Steven Spielberg has announced that he's going to direct it, and so my fingers are crossed on that. That's just sort of incredible news that I kind of feel like maybe I'm dreaming or something. Like someone is playing a really particularly horrible joke on the robot nerd.
Right.
You
give up control, right, of your own work once it gets into a film. Have they consulted you at all about, you know, what the film would look like compared to the book?
At the very beginning, they have built a whole robotic ecosystem of all the robots that are in the book, and the robots in the book are constantly evolving, and they're becoming the machines are studying animals, and they're becoming making the robots much more realistic. Like natural animals, you know, so they're very evolved. And so at the beginning, I saw a lot of artwork and I was able to comment on it and get back and say, you know, this is realistic in this way and this is less realistic. And they really did I saw improvement. I mean, I saw that the robots changed, and that was amazing to me. Hmm. At this point, they're pretty far down the line, and you know, I'm no longer. I'm waiting in line. I'm like camped out in a tent outside the movie theater.
Yeah, I know what that's like. Your own robotics research, was any of that in your book, the stuff that you had worked on?
Yeah, there's a chapter called 22 Seconds, and it's the chapter that takes place in Japan. There's an elderly bachelor who's living in a basically a big automated building that's a sort of half of a hospital and half of a building. It's for people that are getting older, live in these buildings that do a lot of work to take care of them. And that was my research. So I didn't have to ask anybody any questions about that. I was just able to write that right away. So my research was all about building smart environments that could basically keep track of occupants and build these really intimate, intricate models of how people behave so that it could spot when you started to have functional decline and you maybe just needed some help. Because that's pretty much inevitable. And so without a system like this, people can sometimes have one small task that they can't accomplish, and then suddenly they have to go to like a nursing home, you know, and it makes no sense.
Right.
So yeah, 22 seconds. And that is a gory chapter, too.
Talking with
some details.
Daniel L. Wilson, author of Robopocalypse, 1-800-989-8255. Hugh in Oakland. Hi, Hugh.
Hi, good day to you all.
Hey there.
So there's some talk about some computer functions, memory functions, calendar, other things from your PDF, laptops and others being chips being put directly into your brain, sort of like an extension of chips that go into pets and whatnot, but instead they would be more computerized. And that opens up the possibility for hackers potentially plugging directly into the brain too, and wondering if an extension of your precept could be turning people against themselves.
So what you're talking about is a neural implant or a brain computer interface, and they're very common right now. There are cochlear implants that allow people that are deaf to hear. There's retinal implants that allow people that can't see to see. And then the brain computer interface is typically they just put a electrode on usually your motor cortex, and they're able to sense basically the electrical activity in your brain that's triggered whenever you think about moving your body, because this is before your body is actually moving. This is going right to the source. And then you can use that information to do stuff in the environment. So for people who have locked-in syndrome, which is a terrible situation where you're completely paralyzed but fine cognitively, those people can move a mouse cursor simply by thinking about it. And there's this great experiment where they tested this on a monkey, and the monkey is able to grab a banana using a robotic arm by thinking about moving its own arm. So it's pretty incredible. Now, in terms of controlling someone's mind, I don't see that happening because it's really a one-way communication. The electrode is sitting on top of your brain listening to what's going on in there. And not really so much delivering any information. And the closest that you can get to that is probably, I think there's something called deep brain stimulators, which kind of give a natural just a pulse to your brain for people that have like Parkinson's disease in order to try to basically steady out, you know, whenever you have an electrical confusion in your brain like that's associated with epilepsy and things like that. But that's far from brain control. I don't really see any mind control coming through that.
We're talking about...
It's an interesting thought.
Yeah, the next book. Talking about Robopocalypse with Daniel H. Wilson on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Do you think people are really fearful of robots? And they certainly don't realize how many are around us everywhere and controlling everything, do they?
Well,
there's
I think
a
that,
chip
you
in
know,
everything, isn't there?
Yeah, I think that robots are really an embodiment of a bigger fear of just technology in general, you know, because we're so dependent on technology and it's around us all so much now, and it's just there's more and more and the stakes are going up higher and higher. So it's easier to focus on a robot, though.
Do you have a follow-up that you're working on to Robopocalypse?
Yeah, in fact, that question was really appropriate because my follow-up is called AMP, and it's about this near future. There's no robots in AMP, by the way, which is sort of, I know, a departure. But it's about this near future in which people are starting to integrate technology into their bodies a lot, and we're starting to realize that people who we thought were disabled are becoming super abled, and it's really a mind, it's a total shift in thinking, and some people are interested in, not having to implant their children in order to have them be competitive in school. And, I think that adopting new technology is always a change, and it's always scary, but the moment that it starts going into our bodies is going to be a pretty scary moment for civilization. I think it's coming.
And but just to reiterate, even though you're talking about an apocalypse and robo-apocalypse, you don't think there's going to ever be one, an uprising of all these robots? Because?
I don't think that there's going to be an uprising because, I don't think that in order to have that, you need to have this super intelligent entity that sort of appears. And then not only that, but you need it to really, for some reason, want to harm humankind. Now, that said, if you're building a product that people are going to interact with, you have to make it safe. Or you can't build a toaster that's going to electrocute somebody, And if you're building a robot, then you have to be extra careful because they're autonomous. They make their own decisions. So if you're going to put a butler robot in someone's house, well, you got to make sure that if you're holding it under the armpits and it lowers its arm, it's not going to cut someone's fingers off.
But we have worms that go through computers and take them over and do things that we don't want them to. Couldn't that happen with a robot?
Yeah. I think it's much more likely that kind of thing could happen. I mean, in Robopocalypse, there's a chapter at the very beginning, there's a mention of a policeman is asking this kid whether he thinks it was a tele-robbery. Was someone tele-operating this robot in order to rob your store? And, I think that kind of stuff, people will misuse technology whenever they can, and so it's possible.
All right. Well, we're talking with Daniel H. Wilson, author of Robopocalypse. There's a chapter of it on our website if you'd like to. And I want to thank you, Dan, for taking time to be with us today and just leave you with Klaatu Barata Nikto.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thanks again. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about new kinds of concrete, pavement, where the water goes right through it, and other designs in pavement. I know you think pavement is boring. You won't after this segment, so stay with us. We'll be right back. Do you disagree with something our guest said? Maybe something even I said? Or maybe you've got a suggestion for a future show? Well, now you can leave us a voicemail on the telephone. Here's that number, 724-374-3063. That's 724-374-3063. And we might just play it during a future show. But there's only one rule. You've got to keep it short, under 60 seconds. The clock is ticking. 1970 was the year of the first Earth Day, the same year Joni Mitchell wrote her environmental lament, Big Yellow Taxi, about paving over paradise and putting up a parking lot. When Joni Mitchell sang about paving paradise to put up that parking lot, I'm guessing she wasn't thinking of pervious cement, pervious concrete, a more sustainable type of concrete already in use all over the country. Water runs right through it. Yes, it's sturdy enough to pave parking lots and driveways, but so porous it looks just like a Rice Krispie treat. So rainwater trickles right through it down to the ground below rather than running off and flooding storm drains and sewers, and also allows you to actually feed the trees that may have roots running down there and all kinds of stuff underground, returning the water. There are other sustainable paving ideas out there, too, like cement that sucks up greenhouse gases. Or if you got that sticky gunk left over from making biofuel, why not use that as a binder for roads rather than asphalt? My next guests can answer those questions and many more about the brave new world of pavement. Joining me to talk about these technologies are Cheryl Sullivan, senior landscape architect at the Cunningham Engineering Corporation in Davis, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks.
Hi there. John Harvey is professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of California at Davis. He's also director of the University of California Pavement Research Center. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon.
Now, Cheryl, I saw that demonstration. We have actually on our website at sciencefriday.com, we have a video of all this water pouring through the pavement. How does that work?
Well, how does it work? Well, the difference between regular concrete and pervious concrete is that pervious concrete doesn't contain any sand. It just has cement, rock, and water in it. So all the little rocks are coated with this slurry and then put into a form and tamped down, and all the holes remain. Now, pervious concrete will have anywhere from 15 to 20% voids or air pockets within it. So that's how the water drains through it, and it goes into a gravel base underneath.
Is it being used in many places?
It's being used all over the place. It's been in Florida for over 30 years now. It's used up in the northwest, or northeast and northwest. So it's in cold country and dry country and wet country. Mm-hmm. It's, as my grandma used to say, it's the best thing since sliced bread. It's just amazing stuff, but it's so simple.
Yeah. Is it strong enough, though, to be used as highway paving, for example?
We don't use it in highway paving. It doesn't take the high traffic speeds. It will ravel off. The little rock pieces will be spurred off with the high speed. It's used in parking lots, driveways, low-speed alleys, like in condominium complexes or apartment complex, or even in these the urban infills where we have a lot of low-speed alleys. Mm-hmm. And then school grounds can use it. Hospitals are using it. It's all over the place.
How much water, can you give us an idea, can go through this stuff?
Sure. A piece of pervious concrete can have 400 inches of water pass through it in an hour.
Wow.
So it doesn't clog.
So even if it got coated with grime from the road, you know, from car drippings and things like that?
No. Say in Seattle. Seattle, I think the highest... their highest rainstorm is like 5 inches in 24 hours. So even if 90% of the concrete were blocked up, you know, someone had dropped sand in it or dirt or gunk, it still wouldn't be, you would still have enough storage capacity and enough perviousness for that water to not stay on the surface of that parking area or that roadway. So it takes a heck of a lot of stuff to clog up a pervious pavement.
Right. John Harvey, can it then act as sort of a reservoir and store any of that water?
Yeah, the idea, there's two things that you design the pavement for. One is the hydraulic infiltration, as Cheryl was talking about. And we've actually, and the second thing is the structural capacity. Up to now, mostly folks have been putting it down just for cars because, as Cheryl mentioned, it hasn't been designed for the heavier trucks. We've been doing some recent calculations and some research where we tighten the mix down a little bit, make it not quite so permeable, but able to handle a lot of the storms that we have, and then increase the structural capacity. And we're looking at some potential applications of retrofitting the shoulder of the roads so that then they can carry some trucks. They can't carry the high speed, but maybe you can carry some low-speed trucks. And then that pavement, if you put water in it, has been looked at as a way to cool the environment, cool the local environment down around the pavement due to the evaporative cooling.
So you might just actually not wait for the rain, but you might spray water on this pavement and it just evaporates a little bit and cools it off.
Yeah, as a colleague of mine was talking to him earlier today, you know, that's an old technology used around the world is toss some water out on the pavement, and you get the evaporative cooling effect. So there has been some research done by the Public Works Research Institute in Japan, where they've been taking the irrigation water from the medians, the landscaping in between, in the middle of a boulevard, and dropping that water down into the pavement in the late afternoon, and then getting a pretty substantial evaporative cooling during that peak heat time.
I'll tell you, we have this posted on our Facebook at Sci-Fi Facebook page, and we got so much response from this idea. Yeah, it's just, you know, it's amazing. But people were worried about it clogging up, They're worried about, will it freeze? Will it, you know, would expand if there's water in there? Will that expand and break up the pavement in the winter?
I think that I'd like to add one thing to what Cheryl said is also besides pervious concrete, there's also pervious asphalt. There are pervious interlocking concrete blocks. And we actually have our parking lot at our research site. We just have gravel, and it's fine for low volumes of low-speed traffic. There's been some research at the University of New Hampshire that has looked at some, and also I believe Cunningham has done some work in, and some other folks in Pennsylvania, some other freezing environments, and it has not been a major problem from what I've seen because the water actually is down in the gravel, which doesn't really have that big a problem with it, and down next to the soil, so
Right. It all depends on the soil mix and the, you know, what the geotechnical engineer says has to be the depth of the gravel below. But when it's designed properly, there isn't the cracking, the freeze-thaw issues that you have with regular concrete because, as John was saying, it just the water melts and flows down into it, so the rock isn't coated with water.
So
it's great for a parking lot like in Denver when it snows. It starts to melt. The parking lot's dry. You're not left with these icy puddles that you have on a, you know, a regular or conventional asphalt or concrete parking lot. Mm-hmm.
And what happens if there's a gasoline or an oil spill? Would it just sink right through into the ground? Or
yeah, it would. That's why we don't recommend putting it in gas stations, because if you do have a spill like that, you're going to have to take it out and remove it in all likelihood.
Kind of the way we've thought about that, particularly for if we're going to be retrofitting a shoulder of a highway pavement, what happens now when there's a gasoline spill? A lot of it runs off the road and runs into the soil on the shoulder of the road. So in a way, we're actually capturing it in that shoulder or in that pavement. And then there is a lot of as long as you're not going to affect the groundwater, we've been talking to some of our environmental engineers that a lot of the bacteria, as long as you capture it and hold it there, it may not be as big a problem as you might think compared to the, you know, a regular pavement.
Somebody sent us a note saying that in their neighborhood where they have it installed, it has to be vacuum cleaned once a month to get the dust out of the pores.
Well, typically they recommend vacuuming once or twice a year. Perhaps some people may be overly concerned about clogging issues. If you do have this open matrix that dust can fall through and then gets deposited, you know, you have 6 inches of concrete and maybe 6 or 12 inches of gravel underneath it. Unless someone is down dumping, you know, a truckload of sand or soil on top of it, it's not really going to clog it.
All right. Now we've talked so much about it. How can you get your own?
Well, I would certainly recommend that a person, if it's a homeowner, that they hire a contractor who has been a certified pervious concrete installer, because there is a special way to do it, and if you don't do it correctly, it won't work or work as well. And there are a lot of contractors out there now, concrete contractors, who are certified in the application of it. So you can't go down to the local Home Depot and pick up a bag of pervious concrete mix.
That was my question. And John, are there any newer types of paving material that people are looking at?
Well, one of the big questions in the paving world is the quest for what we call the third binder. Mostly we use for binders in pavements in the surface area, asphalt or cement, and asphalt coming from oil refining has a lot of environmental considerations, impacts, and cement also is basically the burning of limestone, which also produces quite a bit of CO2 as well. And so the quest has been for a third binder. There's a lot of work going on right now, some demonstration projects, things like growing algae and processing the algae to try and extract an asphalt-type binder using vegetable-based binders. I've even seen one paper about using pig manure, but not for each. And then in the cement area, there's a new type of cement which is there's a company in California that is demonstrating how to capture the CO2 out of the flue of a power plant and then process that using salt water and some other really innovative chemical processes, and they can produce aggregate, they can produce what we call supplementary cementitious materials, and even some types of cement from that. So they're actually taking the CO2 and out of the stack of a power plant and converting that into road building materials.
Wow. Wow, that's so it's not a boring topic watching the road dry.
No, it's a terrific topic.
All right, I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Okay, thanks a lot, Art.
And good luck to you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Cheryl Sullivan, Senior Landscape Architect at the Cunningham Engineering Corporation in Davis, California. John Harvey, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of California, Davis. This is Science Friday from NPR. That time. That means it's time for this month's episode of Science Diction, where we explore the origins of scientific words. With my guest, Howard Markell, is a professor of a history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, also director of the Center for the History of Medicine there. Welcome back, Howard.
Hello, Ira. How are you?
Hey, what word have you got for us today?
Well, I got a word that I know is near and dear to your heart, radio.
Ah, very near and dear to my heart, yes. You know, I hadn't thought about where radio originated.
It's a great word, but it originates from a type of electromagnetic radiation or waves that propagated through the air.
Right.
It was discovered by the physicist Heinrich Hertz in 1888. So around then, radiation or radiant energy referred to a lot of terms, radioactivity, alpha, beta, gamma, and X-rays. And in 1888, he named his electromagnetic or radio waves that traveled across the ether, which was the atmosphere, at the speed of light. Now, today, we measure units, frequency units, in hertz or megahertz. But back then, in 1888, he said, "My discovery is of no use whatsoever," which was probably the greatest understatement in the history of science.
Huh. So when did it get, linked to the kind of radio we sit around and listen to?
Well, there's a technological step in between. Around 1893, first Nikola Tesla, and the following year, Guglielmo Marconi, and then several others, developed conductors and transmitters and receivers that made it possible to send electrical waves, and then Morse-coded electrical waves, longer and longer distances. By 1901, world news was that Marconi managed to send the letter S in Morse code across the Atlantic Ocean.
Right.
That was big news. That was
big news.
Yeah.
Important.
Yeah. So after that, other people started working on frequency waves that carried the sounds of voice and even music, and that was called radio telephony or telephony. But the point of those things is that they were really communications between two individuals. I'm going to talk to you on the phone, or I'm going to send you a radiogram, which is what those telegrams were called.
Email,
right. Literally email, the original email. But what became the radio, as we understand it, what we're on right now, was based on a whole slew of inventions and creations and discoveries and many historical actors, which is so common in the history of science of any, very complicated device. And by the way, broadcasting, I can't help but tell you that that's an agricultural term, and it meant casting your seeds broadly across a large field. So that's an agricultural term.
Right.
But there were many, many people involved, as I said, and three in particular stand out. The first is a man named Dr. Lee DeForest, and he was a gadgeteer and inventor, and he invented the Audion, which was a glass vacuum tube with prongs that could receive distances, radio signals from long distances. But he didn't know how he invented it. He patented it, but he didn't know why it worked. And he got involved in a lot of fly-by-night businesses and lawsuits for the rest of his career. But another genius was Erwin Howard Armstrong, who between 1912 and 1927 discovered the regeneration circuit and the superheterodyne, which allows us to dial in frequencies and hear them even better. Right. And he even discovered FM, or frequency-modulated radio.
Yeah.
And then the final great man in the history of broadcasting is David Sarnoff, who began working as Marconi's messenger boy, was the telegraph operator when the Titanic was sinking, so that was very lucky. And he founded RCA, which created all these radios and later televisions, and even he created the National Broadcasting Company to put on shows and entertainment that people would want to buy radios for.
All right. And as they say in radio, we've run out of time, Howard.
nice to talk with you.
Thank you. Howard Markel is professor of the history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, also director of the Center for the History of Medicine there. Some of you have asked us, why is it necessary to include ads in these podcasts? It's a good question. The simple answer is we have to find some way to pay for them. NPR does not underwrite our podcasts or any of our social media, like our website or our videos. In fact, they only contribute 10% of our total budget. So instead of charging you for this podcast, we put in a couple of ads. If you'd like to help close that deficit, please go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the support button and donate a few bucks. Thanks.